United Nations Radio presents Beyond Reasonable Doubt.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, concerning this document, we have looked into the whole affair. We have consulted a battery of lawyers. We have searched the records for the last 200,000 years. We have pleasure in informing you that everything is as it should be. Everything is in order. Your title to the deed has been searched, examined, and established beyond reasonable doubt.
The story you are about to hear concerns law, how it began and why, how it developed and why. It also concerns society and how that began and developed. In short, you are about to hear the hand-in-glove and at times tongue-in-cheek account of the joint evolution of human history and human jurisprudence. Our purpose is to show that law and life go together, and that the rule of law is the rule of life, and that neither can exist without the other. The occasion for the program is a most lawful one, the 12th anniversary of the United Nations, an organization built upon a charter in which both law and history meet with compulsive destiny. Your narrator is Quentin Reynolds.
Beyond Reasonable Doubt. Well now, the tale I am here to tell concerns many centuries, past, present, and future. I shall need corroborative evidence from eminent men in each. The future we have not been able to contact. But all those necessary from the past and the present have been approached, and all are willing. Gentlemen, will you come down or up, as the case may be? Gentlemen, please.
What a distinct pleasure to see you. And looking so well, too.
After you, my dear Hammurabi.
General Pompey, how good to see you, old chap.
Prince von Metternich, where have you been?
Ah, Cicero, my old friend.
Socrates, I'm happy to see you so fit.
Is it fit to see me happy? Or are you happy to see me fit?
Same old Socrates, up to your old tricks, I say. Now, did you hear what he said? Did you hear what he told
me? Welcome, gentlemen. Please be seated. I shall call upon you all in historical order. Now for the story. It opens in a certain jungle clearing, somewhere in the third interglacial age. Somewhere in those cold, mist-filled centuries, a momentous event has happened. After uncounted years of wandering alone or in pairs, the species Homo has begun to live in families. The great original transition has been made. Man has abandoned the ways of solitude and has discovered the safety and security of life in society. He is about now to make another momentous discovery. Will Homo Neanderthalensis Jr. step forward, please?
Homo Neanderthalensis Jr., front and center, please.
According to the best available knowledge, sir, you were the first, the very first, to have direct experience of what we now call the long arm of the law. Is that so?
It's right. The arm belonged to my old man, and there was a fist attached to it. That's how it all started, you might say.
Will you tell us how it happened?
Well, it was this way, see. There we were, in our cozy little jungle clearing one day. There we were. Just sitting around the fire, scratching ourselves. Pa and Ma and me, together with some of my brothers and sisters, whom Pa hadn't eaten yet. Pa used to get awful hungry in those days. The fourth glacier age was moving in, and it was getting really cold. Pa wanted the fire stoked up a bit, so he turned around to Ma and me and said,
"Good for nothing, savages, sitting around here with your ugly, hairy faces, your low foreheads and beetle brows. Why don't you stir yourselves a bit? Put a few more logs on the fire. Don't just sit there, scratching your repulsive, hairy skins by the hour."
Oh, me?
Yes, you.
And Ma also.
Yes, your precious Ma, too.
Well, I like that.
Now, Paul, that's not a very nice thing to say. Mom and I may not be what you might call good lookers, but then you couldn't win no beauty prize yourself, neither.
That's telling him, son. river is somewhere over there. Why don't you go and do some useful hunting instead? We ain't never eaten rhinoceros, or woolly mammoth, or bison, or auroch, or muskox.
Yes, Paul, let's have some muskox.
God, we'll only stones and sticks. You know that's all we have to hunt with, idiot.
Oh, Paul.
I'm sick to death of nothing but vegetables. All those hazelnuts, beechnuts, sweet chestnuts, earthnuts, and acorns.
Yes, so am I. They stick in my teeth. Oh, Paul! Oh, Paul!
I see it's high time I planted the seeds of family order.
But, Paul... Oh, Paul!
High time I laid the foundation of social wisdom.
Oh, Paul!
Now, my dear, what would you like me to bring you home for dinner?
Oh, any fig at all, ducks. Any fig at all.
I'm glad you see it my way. And when I get back, I'll have a bit more to say on the subject of family law and order.
So that's how it was in those long-forgotten days where mankind took its first step toward the United Nations Charter, towards the realization that wherever there is society, there must be law. But now history stood on the threshold of another momentous event, an event which changed human life for all time and gave destiny a new direction. Mr. Citizen of Neolithic times, your big moment has arrived. Will you please come forward and tell us what happened?
As I recall it, the time was somewhere around 15,000 BC. As head of tribe, I permitted myself a few, shall we say, luxuries. I'd collected a few rather amiable wives. One day, one of them, whom I always regarded as being the brightest of the lot, came running towards me, brandishing some stalks of wheat.
George! Georgie!
Yes, dear?
Oh, look what I have here.
Give me three guesses. Oats.
Oh, George.
Barley, then.
No, George.
I've known all along, my dear. It's wheat.
Yes, George. But what kind of wheat?
Just good old elf-giving wholesome wheat, full of vitamin B complex and riboflavin. As a friend of mine says, you can't hardly get that kind no more.
Oh, George, you're awful. This is not the plain old wild wheat like we've been reaping for centuries. This wheat I grew.
You did what?
I've made a discovery. I've invented agriculture.
With the coming of cultivation, humanity crashed the time barrier from prehistory into history. Families multiplied rapidly into tribes. Tribes grew into clans, and clans developed into races. Men ceased to wander and began to settle down. They multiplied and discovered themselves numerous on the banks of the Nile, on the banks of the Euphrates and the Tigris, on the banks of the Indus and the Ganges, and on the banks of the Yangtze Chung. Men took root as they had never taken root before. They started felling trees to make room for cities. They started exterminating wild beasts over great areas of the earth. They started building houses. And they started laying out city streets and pavements. And with the first cities in centuries that were still cool in the dawn of history, there came, as they had to, the first codes of civilization. Tribal taboos gave place to deliberate planned legislation. Emperor Hammurabi, your majesty, tell us, sire, what you proclaimed in Babylon 4,000 years ago.
If a man practice brigandage and be captured, that man shall be put to death. If a man knock out a tooth of a man, they shall not.
And then some 1,000 years later, from the land of Judea, came another, the Code of the Hebrews.
A man smiting a man, if he dies, shall surely die. A man smiting his father or his mother shall surely die.
And across the seas and the centuries in the land of Romulus and Remus, the law of the 12 tables.
If a man shall disable the limb of another man, his own limb shall be disabled.
And in the India of Sanskrit times, the divine Manu speaks.
Punishment rules all men. Punishment alone protects them. Punishment is watchful while they sleep. The wise know punishment to be justice.
And in the Greece of classic times, the wise Solon prays.
We humbly beg a blessing on our laws from mighty Jove, and honor and applause.
All the centuries of man have been applauding ever since. These were mankind's first codes of law, the first charters of cooperative conduct, in the first civilized societies. Written on stone, rock, and papyrus, they stood as the first legible signposts on history's crossroads, pointing the way to the century of San Francisco and the United Nations. Laws in early times had one overriding purpose, social peace. But the need for a higher and wider conception of law was waiting around history's corner. In the Grecian city where the wise Solon had promulgated his laws. What did your tables of Athenian laws do, sir?
Well, among other things, I made it compulsory for citizens to take an active and direct part in the management of city affairs. This government by the demos, the people, brought about what I believe was history's very first example of democracy.
Thank you, Citizen Solon. And democracy brought with it a new conception of both the nature and the function of law in society. Citizen Aristogeithon, now, sir, it is your turn. Citizen Aristogeithon, I knew you went through embarrassing trial.
Yes.
But that is precisely what we need to recall. So would you be good enough to tell us how that rather unfortunate event took place in your life and what came of it?
Well, it was a rather pleasant, sunny day, and I was out looking for prospective clients. I was a lawyer. We used to be called sycophants. Your modern term is solicitor. The meaning is much the same. As I was saying, I was out looking for clients. Not an easy job, as you know, at the best of times, and particularly difficult if you're not popular. And I wasn't. In fact, some people had gone to the extent of giving me the opprobrious nickname of Dog to express their disapproval. So there I was, walking down the street that sunny day.
Hey! Here there!
Well, gentlemen, what can I do for you?
We are not gentlemen, Aristogeiton. We are officers of the law sent here to apprehend you.
Apprehend me? Officers of the law? I don't understand. What have I done?
Have you not refused to pay several debts? Have you not pretended lameness in order to escape military service? And did you not decline to pay for the burial of your father when he died?
The debts were small and negligible. I dislike military service and reserve my right as a free citizen of Athens to feign any deformity or illness I like. And as for refusing to bury dead fathers, is there a law against that?
Come, come, we've no time to waste. The Helioi awaits. Say what you have to say to the Decasts and Demosthenes.
I did present my case to the Decasts, the jury. There were 500 of them present in the open-air court that day. No one wanted to miss that trial, Demosthenes having spread word that he planned to be in top oratorical form. I had spoken in my defense rather well, I thought. But by the time Demosthenes had come to winding up for the prosecution, he had the jury eating out of his hand.
Men of the jury! Men of Athens! That Aristogiton is called a dog? I don't have to tell you. You know that already. I shall not speak of his being a human monster, though among such monsters he stands first, middle, and last. I shall not speak of these things, as for these things he cannot probably be held to blame. But I shall speak of his violating the laws of the city. He has told you that he is a free citizen and can do as he pleases. By heaven, suppose every citizen had the boldness and impudence of this Aristogiton. Suppose all reasoned with themselves as he does, that a man may say or do what he pleases in a democracy without restraint. Suppose each individual, banishing order and discipline from his life, regarded his own will as the law. What would happen then, O men of Athens? Could any government then go on? How say ye? The whole life of men, O Athenians, whether they inhabit a great city or a small one, is governed by law. Laws alone make possible civilized life. They are an invention of the gods, a resolution of wise men, a corrective of errors, intentional and unintentional, a compact of society, according to which all who belong to society ought to live. No man may be allowed to put society in peril by disobeying its laws. Your judgment now, O men of Athens.
I'm happy to say that I escaped death.
And jail, citizen?
No, I didn't escape jail. I had much time there to ponder the words of Demosthenes on the role of law in democratic societies.
And your conclusion, citizen?
That laws in democratic societies are not merely means of preserving peace, but also of promoting welfare. Their function enlarges from that of merely reconciling individual human wills into that of satisfying collective human wants. As one of our greatest thinkers, Aristotle, was to put it, laws come into existence originally for the sake of mere life, but they continue in existence for the sake of the good life.
Thank you, citizen Aristogiton. Go back to your chair in peace, and thank you.
Thank you.
And there were other men of thought in Greece who pondered upon law also and upon its place in the life of nations. Their thinking gave law new dimensions which have shaped all the centuries since. Notable among these philosophic Greeks was one Socrates. Of a stonemason, son. Of appearance, sloven. Of mind, subtle. His favorite haunts were Athenian temples. His favorite pastime was to corner Athenian youth for involved and often disconcerting philosophic dissertations. Is that not so, Socrates?
Yes. Well, I must confess that many thoughts. Indeed, I believe my methods of discussion had much to do with some citizens inviting me to partake of the hemlock.
Didn't you once, sir, begin a discussion on the nature of law and finish up with the law of nature?
Yes, I believe the conversation that day went somewhat like this.
Greetings, O Socrates.
Greetings, O Minos. Tell me, O fair-minded Minos, what is law?
Oh, I know the traps thou art in the habit of setting for the unwary, O Socrates. I shall not be caught. I shall say only that law is law.
That serves my purpose well, Minos. So, let us say that law is what is.
That is just what I say.
I'm glad thou thinkest it, sir. Now, tell me, since law is what is, what are those things which are, and are, therefore, law?
Oh, that would seem clear. They are the decrees of the state.
Is it necessary to consider law as something beautiful and to seek it as a thing which is good in itself?
How not?
Now, we have said, have we not, that law is a decree of the city?
Oh, we have said so. Mm-hmm.
But are not some decrees good and some evil?
Oh, they are.
But thou hast agreed, hast thou not, that law is good?
I have so. Mm-hmm.
And so it cannot be evil at the same time.
I have an appointment for which I'm getting rather late. If thou wouldst forgive me, I'll run along.
No, stay, my friend. Let us finish this most instructive dialogue. What, then, is law?
I give up.
Why, that is simple, my lord. Law is law.
But that is exactly what I said.
And I agree with thee. Law is law because it is. Now, what is can only be if it is according to nature. Therefore, since the nature of law is to state what is, and since what is can only be if it is according to nature, it must be in the nature of law to follow the law of nature. Is that clear? And so, my friend, we have established that the nature of law is to be found only in the law of nature. And this nature is common to all men and all nations. So, law must also be common to all men and all nations. Now I have finished with you. Get thee hence, get thee hence.
The distinction between law and the laws, between the rules of law, which may vary from nation to nation and be either good or bad, and law itself, which is always good and common to all nations, is perhaps the most important contribution made by Greece to legal thought. In Athens itself, the thought remained, as it had to, in the realm of philosophy. The conditions for giving it a more practical expression had not yet been born, but they soon were, and their birthplace was called Rome. General Pompey, will you please tell us what you did for your native land?
Gladly. Rome, you see, was a city-state. But gradually, inevitably, like the swelling tide of fate, the world became its hinterland. The years produced the need for Roman expansion. The need produced us, the Roman generals, and we, the generals of Rome, produced Roman results. Recall, if you will, just one memorable occasion. It was the last of the BC centuries. The year was 62. I had just come back home once again in triumph. I had already brought victories home. First from Europe, and then from Africa. Now I was leading Asia through the Roman streets. My armies and I had swept through 15 countries, 1,000 military strongholds, 900 cities, and 39 towns. I had brought back with me many talents worth of gold and silver and a dozen shiploads of kings, princes, generals, and royal hostages. The people were wild with joy.
They love me in Rome.
With the world lying at our Roman doorstep, with our domain so wide that Alexander's whole empire fitted in as a mere province, it became both possible and necessary for us Romans to take a world view of society and of law.
Well, that's all I have to say on the subject, but my friend, Senator Cicero, here has something to add, I believe. Cicero?
Senator Cicero. Sir, if you will.
There is but one law by which the society of men is held together, and one lex has established it. For the likeness of all men to each other is far greater than their differences in mind and thought, in virtue, and even in vices.
Most interesting. Please go on, sir.
This law needs no interpreter or expounder but itself. Nor will there be one law in Rome and another in Athens, one in the present and another in time to come. But there shall be one law, eternal and immutable, embracing all peoples and all time. One who looks about him must see that man is in reality a citizen of the world, as of one great city.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, too, General. You may return to your seats. When Rome fell, the vision of world unity under one world law fell also from the horizons of political possibility. The empire, which was a city, disintegrated into a patchwork of feudal factions. The concept of a unifying law of nature lay buried under the debris of shattered centuries. But throughout the sleeping middle years of Europe's life, the need for a legal reawakening built itself with gathering pressure. Scan those now distant years in rapid retrospect. First there came the Crusades, the clash of faith upon faith, of steel upon steel. The Crusades brought Europe's dark ages into contact with the sunlit East. All over the continent, thousands called for the softer and spicier ways of life they had found in the Orient.
Wife, where is the nutmeg? I can't eat this fish without nutmeg. It gives odors that are unfriendly to my nostrils.
The demand for spices and silks led to the search for sea routes to the fragrant lands of the East.
I am Cristoforo Colombo, my queen. I tell thee, the world is round.
The great voyages of geographic discovery interlocked with the great rebirth of the human mind. The Renaissance merged into the Reformation. The Reformation brought the prolonged, bitter wars of the religions. And out of this war rose the Treaty of Westphalia.
Be it known to each and every one who is concerned, or howsoever he may be concerned, that after the conflicts and the civil commotions, which had their origins many years ago, had increased to a point where a long and bitter war was started, it finally came to pass, by divine goodness, that the 11th day of July in the year of Christ 1643 was agreed upon for the beginning of a congress of plenipotentiaries at Munster and Osnabrück, in Westphalia.
and the Treaty of Westphalia gave rise to the modern nation-state. All over the crowded landmass of Europe, men found themselves living without the unifying institutions of political allegiance to the Western Emperor and spiritual subordination to the Pope. Nations recognized no superiors now and faced the world with newborn arrogance and pride. And all over the crowded landmass of Europe, there arose men to explain and defend that newborn reality, national sovereignty. Ah, Monsieur Bodin, since you have joined us, could we have your views?
Enchanté. I was the first to use the phrase sovereignty. I held that sovereign states, being sovereign, are above the law. They are the law.
And now, Mr. Hobbes, we understand you have put this entire matter of sovereignty in your usually forthright terms, correct?
Yes, my dear fellow, you're dead right. I was the one who wrote the book called Leviathan, borrowed the name from Hebrew poetry, means some kind of a sea monster. That's what sovereign states are, as far as other states are concerned, monsters. In international relations, there's only one law, that of the jungle. You can put it this way. Every nation for itself, and may God help the weakest.
With national self-esteem thus philosophically reinforced, nations stood now in aggressive pride all over the continent of Europe, striking attitudes of challenge and of defiance. All about them in those expansive centuries stretched the wide world of spice-laden islands, of empires waiting to be built, and of distant western horizons begging to be explored. Men set sail in all four directions across the seven seas under a dozen flags. Nations began to stake out liquid claims upon the restless oceans, as they had already done upon the more patient miles of unmoving land.
The Adriatic belongs to the sovereign Republic of Venice.
The Ligurian Sea belonged to us. Us of the sovereign Republic of Genoa.
To the Catholic Kingdom of Portugal belongs the whole of the Indian Ocean and the whole of the Atlantic south of Morocco.
The Pacific, together with the Gulf of Mexico, is the exclusive domain of Spain.
Thus came the historic collision, the collision of sovereignties at sea, from which history was destined to fashion an important lesson. The beginnings can be traced to a certain day when a certain ship, under a certain English captain, sailed into a certain English harbor.
Ahoy there! Ahoy!
Ahoy there, Drake! Ahoy! Hurrah for the Golden Hind! She's returned!
Home again! England once again! Round the world and back to England after 3 years, my men! How fares the English Queen, my countrymen? Is she alive and well?
The Queen! To the Queen! God bless the Queen!
Like a visitation from on high did I and my men descend upon the coast of Chile, that land which lies beside the Pacific waves. We have shown the Spaniards that no frontiers may be erected before an English bark. England sails where England pleases.
The Spaniards took a somewhat different view from that of Francis Drake about that famous voyage. His Excellency Ambassador Bernardino de Mendoza, Envoy Extraordinary of His Catholic Majesty Philip II, King of Spain, acting upon royal instructions, sought an audience with the Virgin Queen in order to lodge a formal protest.
Proceed, Ambassador. You have my permission to speak. I said you have my permission to speak, not to cough.
May it please your majesty.
I am not pleased.
But, madame, you have not even heard me yet.
But I have seen you, and that is enough. And what I see does not commend itself to me.
Your majesty is plain spoken.
I speak plainly most of the time. I lie only for amusement, not for deception. I am English.
I can only see through Spanish eyes, madame, and therefore...
Spanish eyes, stiff! Why Spanish eyes? What, pray, is wrong with English eyes? In any case, stop beating around the bush and come to the point. What is on your mind?
As I was saying, madam...
You were saying nothing. You were only coughing and blabbering something about Spanish eyes. To the point, ambassador. To the point.
Well then, madame. It's about a sea captain of yours. One Francis Drake.
One Francis Drake, did I hear you say? One Francis Drake. The Francis Drake, if you please. In fact, Sir Francis Drake. I shall dub him a knight of the realm. What about Drake?
He's a pirate.
Rubbish, he's English.
That's besides the point.
Oh, so you have a point. Well, what is the point, then?
The point is, Your Majesty, that Drake had no right whatsoever to sail his English bark through the Pacific Ocean. The Pacific Ocean is by virtue of the bull promulgated by His Holiness Pope Alexander, the sole and exclusive property of my royal master, His Most Catholic Majesty, Philip II, King of Spain. No ship of any foreign flag may ply the waters of my royal master's Pacific domain without his royal consent.
Have you said what you had to say?
Yes, madame. And Your Majesty will find that your Prime Minister, William Cecil, recognizes that Spanish sovereignty over the Pacific has been wantonly violated.
You make numerous errors, Ambassador. Take them one by one. Primus, William Cecil is and has been for the past 9 years Lord Burley. Can you refer to him as such? Secundus, Lord Burley, whom you have called William Cecil, is not my Prime Minister. I am my own minister on all matters of state and seek counsel from no one. And Tertius, no Spanish sovereignty has been violated in the Pacific Ocean because the Pacific does not and cannot belong to Spain alone. The Pacific Ocean, like all oceans, is and must remain open to the vessels of all nations. My good man, the use of the sea is common to all. No title to any ocean can belong to any one nation, since neither nature nor regard for public use permits any exclusive possession. Putting it briefly and in Latin, Ambassador, mare est liberum. Go tell that to your royal master.
Mare liberum, the free seas. 29 years after Queen Elizabeth's interview with the Spanish ambassador, a book appeared which was destined to become the foundation of the modern law of nations. The author of the book was a Dutch lawyer by the name of Hugo Crotius. Mein Herr Crotius, will you step forward, please?
Gladly.
What was the view you expressed in your book?
As a matter of fact, I wrote 2 books. The first one was known as Mare Liberum. Or, if you prefer the full title, it was called Mare Liberum soi de jure quod Batavis competit et indicana commercia dissertatio.
You don't say.
In this book, I endorse the Elizabethan view that since the sea is free by the law of nature, being incapable of physical possession, it must also be free by the laws of man. But it is my second book that I regard as being more important. The title of this one was...
The shorter one this time, I beg you.
De jure belli ac pacis, concerning the law of war and peace.
The substance, sir.
I now dealt with the question of sovereignty not only upon the sea, but with the principle of sovereignty as a whole. I show that sovereignty does not place nations beyond the law. Indeed, it makes laws even more necessary. Since the sovereign nations share a common world, they must have a common law among themselves, a law binding each in the interest of all.
Thank you, mein Herr Croesus.
Tot uw dienst, meneer.
So are the seeds of social wisdom planted by you and others who thought like you in that distant 17th century. They were then planted for the family of nations, as 200,000 years earlier they had been planted by Paleolithic Pa for the family of man. But though the seeds were planted, it took centuries to compel their growth. The compulsion came as a matter of life and death, a matter of both ever-expanding opportunities for a richer life and for a more massive collective death. Take the matters of life first. 1769, the Industrial Revolution.
Industrial competition is ruinous to all. We must regulate wages and conditions of labor by international treaty.
1804.
Das ist ja ganz unmöglich. This is impossible. This is chaos. There are trains all over Europe, but still you cannot travel from one country into another because each has different rules and different fares. We must reach international understanding on inter-European railway traffic.
1844.
Telegraph messages are held up at every border for days, each nation demanding payment for onward transmission at its own independent sovereign rates of payment. This is ridiculous. We must set up some rules for all to obey.
And so it went, each new expanding opportunity for a richer life, creating the need for wider laws of common obedience. They came, even though it took time for them to break through the stubborn ramparts of national sovereignty. At first they were inclined to say,
Nein.
No.
No.
But soon these words changed a little. Soon they said,
Vielleicht.
Peut-être.
Perhaps.
But they finally had to start saying,
Ja.
Oui.
Yes.
So treaties multiplied, treaties creating new laws to regulate the expanding ways of international life. And then there were also the expanding ways of death, creating their own needs. Between 1803 and 1815, the wars of Napoleon, fought with guns, rifles, and horses. After that, they had to meet. Prince von Metternich, as one of the illustrious participants in the Congress of Vienna, could you tell us what you did in 1815?
Oh, we had ourselves a ball, as I believe they say in America these days. There has never been anything like it. All those count heads, diplomats, and the aristocracy and...
Sorry to interrupt, Prince, but we are more interested at the moment in the political and legal rather than the social aspects of the Congress. What did you do politically?
We redrew the map of Europe, liquidating the problems Napoleon had created.
Did you try to set up any universal rule of law for nations to obey?
No. The need for it wasn't there in my time. The moment wasn't ready.
Thank you, Prince. And then there came another war, 1914 to 1918. Fought with bigger guns, better rifles, and also with inventions called U-boats and aeroplanes. The need was getting bigger also and easier to recognize.
The high contracting parties, in order to promote international cooperation and to achieve international peace and security, by the firm establishment of the understanding of international law as the actual rule of conduct among governments, agree to this Covenant of the League of Nations,
And then there came yet another war. They called it the Second. Fought with still bigger guns, still better rifles, still better versions of the U-boats, and a still larger alphabet of death. V for V-bombs, and A for the bomb which was atomic. Could be heard as never before. It was there now, beyond reasonable doubt. And so they spoke at last. Not kings and emperors, not high contracting parties, but we, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women and of nations large and small, and to establish conditions under which justice and respect for the obligations arising from treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained, have resolved to combine our efforts to accomplish these aims. Our story ends, the story of mankind's title deeds to a common humanity under a common law. The lawful story, which began as a narrow trail in some now-forgotten forest clearing some 200,000 years ago, widening with each pressure of history's needs to its present dimensions of chartered universality, to the law of the United Nations. Contained in one preamble, 111 articles, and one special annex, this universal law can be reduced to just one big don't.
No nation may, henceforth, claim the sovereign right of war. No nation may use force or the threat of force as a means of settling international disputes.
And this universal law can also be reduced to just one big do.
All nations shall seek to harmonize their conflicting political interests through every available means of peace, and shall cooperate, each with the other, in ensuring social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom for all.
Is this law always obeyed? Perhaps not. But if laws are always obeyed, they would become unnecessary, as Plato taught in the distant dead decades.
Laws are made for an imperfect, not a perfect world.
Or as Secretary General Hammarskjöld has said for decades that now live.
It is easy to say that it is pointless to state a law if it cannot be enforced. However, to do so is to forget that if the law is the inescapable law of the future, it would be treason to the future not to state the law simply because of the difficulties of the present.
The inescapable law of the future. That is our exit for the present. The present where the past lives forever and where the future dies each newborn moment to be buried in the ever-living past. We have journeyed to this concluding moment through the inescapable crossroads of history's 200,000 lawful years. We shall all surely meet again, the past, the present, and the future, at some other inescapable crossroads, another 200,000 years hence. And if we do, of this you may be sure, it will be through law, and law alone. That, ladies and gentlemen, is beyond reasonable doubt.
You have been listening to Beyond Reasonable Doubt, a special presentation on the origin and growth of law reaching out through the centuries to the United Nations Charter. The narrator was Quentin Reynolds. Music was composed and conducted by Charles Paul. The program was brought to you in commemoration of United Nations Day. It was written by Goal O'Brien, with special effects by Hal Johnson. Beyond Reasonable Doubt was produced by the international staff of United Nations Radio.